This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, I'm here with Richard Halston from Wine Intelligence. Wine Intelligence do market research for the wine industry. How are you, Richard?
Very well, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. We might as well start with how you guys started. You've only been going for about 5 years now.
That's correct. We started because we were all frustrated, us three founders, with our lack of understanding of consumers in the various bits of the wine industry that we worked in. For my part, I was working for Virgin Wines, which was a direct-to-home wine retailer that we started at Virgin Group about 6 years ago. And my job there was to try and find new customers. Important job, really, because without customers, the business didn't work. And I was very frustrated at the fact that I couldn't really understand and target the people who I thought might be the potential customers for this organization. In another part of the forest, my wife, Luli, was working for Thresher Group in a role that essentially involved her developing wine category strategy and acting as a sort of liaison between the marketing and the buying functions of the group. And she too was finding it quite difficult to understand what it was that consumers going into her shops really wanted, and therefore trying to improve how the company bought and merchandised its offer. And the third founder, Brian, was running an importing and distribution business focused on mid to high end off-trade and on-trade in the southeast of England. And he too was finding the problem of how to introduce new products to customers in a way that reduced the risk of such products failing. So, you know, trying to understand a bit more again about how consumers felt about particular regions, varietals, and styles, so that he could essentially help his clients place more effective bets on what to serve and what to offer on their wine lists.
Why couldn't you get the information from something like AC Nielsen, for example? You know, or was there no one else in the market at that time?
Well, winding the clock back to when we started the business, clearly there were big research houses like AC Nielsen and like Taylor Nelson that offered information about the category or about the consumer. In AC Nielsen's case, they had and still have an excellent way of telling us what is selling and how much is selling. What is less clear is who's buying, why they're buying, what they're using it for, and whether they're going to buy it again.
They get most of that information from the supermarkets, don't they?
That's correct. So most of the Nielsen data, in fact, all the Nielsen data comes from a interface between the electronic point of sale systems that most major grocers and multiple retailers have and their systems, which aggregate and analyze this information and therefore tell us whether we're brand owners of, you know, soap powder or dog food or indeed wine, what's selling and how much of it is selling. And whilst this information is very useful, it's also very expensive. And it also doesn't tell you, as I say, kind of the why. It doesn't answer the question, well, why did someone buy this? And what are they going to do with it? And are they going to buy it again?
And also who bought it, what sort of person they are, whether they're a coal miner or a city lawyer.
Correct.
Okay, so that's where you guys try and put your difference in there, yeah?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's the sort of macro level. If you go into more detail, what you realize very quickly if you work in the wine industry is that this is not like any other industry. There is a diversity of product on the shelves. There is a fragmentation in the supplier base that you really don't see pretty much anywhere else in consumer goods anymore. And that demands, therefore, a different approach to the way you research the market and supply data back to these people who need to make the same decisions that, you know, Unilever and Procter and Gamble make about, you know, what chocolate bars people want to eat or, you know, the ice creams and so on. But they don't necessarily have the scale to purchase heavy-duty research every week to, you know, to make those decisions.
So how do you guys find out the information? You know, what sort of tools do you guys use to determine who's buying what wine and why?
Well, we use a variety of techniques. The most obvious ones that you would normally expect a research company to use are things like surveys, consumer surveys, and then interview research, which can take the form of me sitting across the table from, well, someone like yourself, Chris, and instead of you asking me questions, I'm asking you questions about what you drank last night, what you're going to be drinking this evening, what you like, what you don't like.
I like it better when I ask you the questions.
Yeah. I think the same is true for me. When we do that on a more sort of bigger scale, we do use things like focus groups and occasionally things like hall tests, which are product tests that take place in environments where consumers would normally be, where we just ask them to either, you know, taste something or look at something and tell us what they think of it. Yeah. And, you know, there are obviously other techniques that we use, but pretty much those are the main ones we use to just try and get information out of consumers and supply it back to our clients, which is what they pay us to do.
And what sort of things are you pulling out? Is it, you know, is it purchasing behavior patterns? You know, whether they felt particularly good buying a bottle of wine, or what sort of information is it?
Well, yes, is the answer. It's all that and more. And you know, there really is a very broad sweep of things that we need to understand from consumers as an industry. You know, what they're buying and why is probably, you know, the best place to start. But also what they think of things. You know, whether their perception of wine from Australia is to do with their perception of Australia, or their perception of the bottle of you know, Jacob's Creek they drank last night,
or Kylie Minogue,
or indeed Kylie Minogue, or the fact that the Australians are very good at you know, Olympic sports, or that they're poor losers, or that they, you know, or in the case of the Ashes, they're pretty good losers, but they may well come and wallop us again come the new year.
Okay, what sort of clients then do you guys have? You know, who uses your skills, and what are they using it for?
Well, the bulk of our client base, I suppose you could describe as people who make wine and sell wine to retailers. So it's not the retailers themselves, it's the people who actually own the vineyards, own the tanks, and own the brands.
Okay, so that would be things like, I'm not naming any particular brands, you know, but it might be some Australian brands that people are aware of. It could be small producers in the Languedoc or anything like that. Is that the sort of thing?
Yeah, I think, you know, ironically, we're doing a piece of work at the moment for a big Australian producer, and we're doing a piece of work for a small collection of French producers. So there, you know, there you go. There is the diversity of our client base, and chiefly what they're interested in finding out is, you know, what products they should be making for, you know, the marketplace, either in this country or in, you know, the other key export markets, which is where we also work, and also what sort of consumers they should be targeting to be the, you know, most appropriate people to purchase this product. Yeah. You know, so for instance, it's a very nice Australian single estate Shiraz at $8.99. Who's going to be buying that?
Yeah.
Well, actually, the answer is not that many people, at least not compared to something at $2.99, because, you know, not that many people spend that much money on wine. But it's clearly a segment of the population. And if you are effective at targeting that segment, more so than the other wines you can buy at $8.99, then, you know, you've got more chance of staying on the shelf, you've got more chance of getting into people's baskets, and you've got more chance of making a bit of money that you can then put into the vineyard.
What do you think is one of the big purchasing decisions for someone going into the supermarket? You know, they look at the shelves. What's driving their purchase decision?
I think the first thing that they think of when they go into the supermarket and they walk into the wine aisle is, oh my goodness. Oh, wow, what a choice. And generally speaking, the purchase decision process flows from the need to try and make some rational sense of this very diverse, fascinating, but potentially confusing category. What most people use are what we would call in the marketing world heuristics, which is a posh way of saying some kind of sign, mark, brand, or you know, familiar term that you can use to narrow down your choice. So, for instance, I'm a particular fan of Pinot Noir. So I would look out, if I was buying a bottle of red wine, I would look out for bottles that said Pinot Noir on them, mm-hmm. As a way of narrowing my choice down from all the red wines in Tesco to the ones that might be of interest to me. And then once within Pinot Noir, I might choose a product that came from a particular region because I like that region, or it came from a particular brand because I like that brand. And then at some point, price would come into the equation, and that's just me because, you know, I'm more interested in the product than I am in the price, albeit that I am, at the end of the day, still as much of a cheapskate as anyone else, and I don't want to pay any more than I absolutely have to for the product. So, you know, at some level, price would be a factor that I would have to consider.
What about package design? Is that a big factor? You know, whether it's got polka dots on the front label, or is that less of a thing as the grape variety in the region?
I think it varies from consumer to consumer. I don't think you can make generalizations about all consumers. One of the reasons we exist is to try and make some generalizations, but to understand that, you know, consumers aren't all the same. I think if you asked consumers to say, how much does the package, the label, what it looks like, how much does it matter, which is what we do, a lot of them say, well, not very much. The truth of the matter is actually it does matter, but not necessarily in a sort of conscious way or a way that you're willing to admit. Yeah. There are bottles that I would probably like to drink, you know, that would fit with my need on that particular evening or day, but I would never purchase because, frankly, they look terrible. They would jar my sense of myself and my world if I had them on my dinner table. Yeah. And I think, you know, if you're looking at sort of where does packaging design come in, and that's a lot of the work we do, it's actually making sure that the design fits with what the product is. It's giving you sufficient information about it to allow you to the reassurance levels and the confidence levels to purchase it, understanding that people aren't buying a pretty picture. They're buying, you know, Chilean Sauvignon Blanc. But what they're looking for is a way of buying something that looks right, that's going to feel right to them, and is going to taste right.
You mentioned earlier about helping people to get the product right. You know, we talked a bit about packaging. When we interviewed Matthew Cooper from Alice, he was talking about different wine styles for the US market versus the UK market. Are you finding people are coming to you guys saying, you know, what should I be making to try and sell into the UK market?
I think this is a really interesting issue. And, you know, without necessarily going into it in too much detail, I think the idea that people in different countries have different taste preferences or profiles, whatever you want to call it, is kind of one of those emerging issues that we're dealing with at the research level, but also that brand owners and wine producers are dealing with. I think the jury's still out as to whether this is something that it should influence how people make wine, but I think there's clearly a scope for more investigation. Anecdotally, I would say that there is probably a taste profile in America in general that is different from the taste profile in the UK. I think they like a bit more alcohol and a bit more sugar and a bit more sort of, you know, knock your socks off flavor. But clearly that's a, you know, gross generalization, and it doesn't answer for, you know, a lot of people in America who like, you know, very delicate and you know, floral products, and people in the UK who, you know, quite fancy a big knock your socks off, you know, 15 degree Chardonnay with a load of oak in it.
Sure. I imagine Chardonnay has been the current whipping boy for most of the industry. How do you guys feel about that? Because Chardonnay does make quite nice wine. You get a big diversity of range, but at the moment, you know, if you were to put a wine grape down, you'd probably pick on Chardonnay.
Yes. Well, I think there's two things going on here. One is the tallest poppy syndrome, where, you know, Chardonnay is by some distance the most popular white wine grape in the world. And when you're that popular, you're clearly going to have people who make it their business to criticize you or do you down. You know, if Chardonnay was a person, I suspect they would probably be someone who would appear in Hello Magazine saying, oh, people, they just don't understand me. You know, in terms of the styles that you know, you can get of Chardonnay, obviously you can get a great diversity of style. And I think where Chardonnay's reputation, to put it in probably the most diplomatic way possible, comes from is from, you know, the rather sort of poor quality examples of oaked Chardonnay that you know we saw in the UK market at least a few years ago, and that actually you look quite hard to find these days. I think there's now a strong market in unoaked Chardonnay, be it unoaked Chardonnay that people never knew was Chardonnay in the first place, like Chablis, for instance, which, you know, in a sample of 50 consumers, probably 80% will still not know that one and the other are synonymous, because their perception of Chardonnay is, you know, it's big, yellow and oaky, not minerally and light like Chablis is. But the examples that are even coming out where you've got oak and where you've got, you know, quite sort of strong flavours are much more sophisticated now, certainly if you're willing to pay, you know, more than £3 or £4 for the bottle, than there were a few years ago.
We talked a bit about people looking at what the consumer likes to make the wine. Do you think there's a risk that if everybody tries to find out what the consumer wants, you're going to land up everybody making the same wine? You know, it's like design, like committee, you know, all you're going to do is land up with the grey and bland.
I mean, obviously there's always a danger that by, you know, going for consensus on something, you end up with something that, frankly, everyone sees as bland. You know, from the wine industry's point of view, that's very unlikely ever to happen, because this is an industry that's driven by very strong personalities, by very clear visions of what people should be producing. And the day will not come where you have four flavours of wine on the shelf, because it's just not in the nature of the category. Having said that, when we're developing new products alongside our partners and clients, we have to be very careful, on the one hand, to make sure that we're not alienating the vast majority of our target audience, but on the other hand, to make sure that we're not just going to be a so what me too ho-hum type of product. And as you might imagine, that's a pretty difficult balance to strike.
Do you think a wine like the old Git would have made it through the wine intelligence design process?
It's a very excellent question, Chris, and one that I'm going to have to come back to you on, because clearly we need to put this or something similar to it into a design process and see what people think of it. But I think to try and answer your question, there is a danger when you research anything that you're going to get an answer back that basically says consumers don't like anything that they're not familiar with or that doesn't sort of fit with their stereotype. So, you know, on the one hand, you have this problem when you're developing a new product that research may not support that new product because it falls outside what people expect.
Yeah.
Having said that, you know, it may fall outside what people expect because the new product is rubbish. And people actually would never buy it in a million years because it's got, you know, some kind of fluorescent label on it. And, you know, that's not why people buy wine. Okay, so, you know, I think it's down on the one hand to the researchers and strategists such as ourselves, but on the other hand to the clients and also people like the retail buyers, you know, to use a degree of common sense when interpreting information and making decisions about, you know, what product to make next.
Talking about retailers, a couple of retailers have changed the way they approach their wine sales. Thresher's was a classic one where they went from selling bottles of wine to now trying to promote three for the price of two. What's your opinion on that? And Ogden's are changing their pricing mechanism this month. So what do you think about, say, for example, the Thresher's three for two and the new mechanisms that Ogden's are looking at?
Well, firstly, just to talk about Thresher's for a minute. My hat is off to them in terms of coming up with a very effective trading strategy in what must be probably the most challenging market conditions any retailer can currently face. If you're Thresher's, you're competing with, you know, some of the most powerful multiple grocer businesses in the world, and who have buying power that far outstrips yours. So I think for a trading strategy, buying two and then getting a third one, quote unquote, free, though if you look at the prices very carefully, I don't know to what extent that actually is free. You know, you appear to be paying for some of it in the two that you're actually buying first of all. The advantage of that is, from Thresher's point of view, is that suddenly people who were going in and buying one bottle for an emergency or a convenience purchase are now buying three bottles in effect. So they've increased their sales without really necessarily having to increase the footfall, the number of people going into the store, by, you know, a huge margin. Although that has also increased because people now see these big three for the price of two signs on the outside of the store, and now there's a reason to go in.
And what about Odbin's new strategy? They're trying to position themselves almost like Asda, everyday low pricing. How do you think that'll work?
Well, I'd be really interested to see a bit more of the detail about, you know, the way Odbin's are now headed. Having heard the announcement, as reported in the press, that they're not going to be promoting wines heavily, individual bottles of wine, and that they're going to try and reach this sort of equilibrium price point for their bottles of wine across the whole range and, you know, across time, so they're not going to vary their pricing, it produces, I suppose, a sense of reassurance in consumers that they're not, you know, being ripped off because they don't see a deal sign. On the other hand, it doesn't necessarily give them a reason to go into the store. And I think the big challenge for Odbin's, if they're going to go down this route, is what is their consumer's reason to walk into that shop? Now, if it's the traditional reason that people used to walk into Odbin's, which was because the staff were knowledgeable, the range was interesting, and they could always guarantee that they'd find something that they would like, either based on recommendation or you know, browsing the shelves, then they've got to make a lot more of that. And they also have to be convinced that actually there's a significant chunk of consumers out there who want that kind of level of involvement in wine and are willing to perhaps pay a little bit more than they would have to in Tesco to get that level of service.
So it's a bit of a wait and see approach to see what actually happens with their new pricing.
Yeah, but I think we have to acknowledge, and I think Odbin's internally, I'm sure, do acknowledge that going to a strategy of no promotions and everyday low pricing, which, you know, someone like Asda tried and had sort of stepped back from a little bit because they realized that their consumers, at least, did quite like the sort of pizzazz of the deal.
Everybody likes to think they've got a bargain, don't they?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a very powerful retail tool. And if you say, no, I am renouncing that as part of my trading strategy, then something else has got to fill that hole.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you've got no reason for someone to walk into the shop. So I would say, you know, it's a risk that they're taking. You know, I welcome, as I'm sure a lot of other people in the industry do, the idea that you can sell wine on something other than price, because I think, you know, there are clear indications that the industry as a whole has suffered because of this obsession with price cuts and low price points in our category. But, you know, we have to take very seriously the idea that consumers do like that approach and will not necessarily go for the, you know, everyday low pricing angle unless there's a clear reason to buy built into that that perhaps is something other than to do with price.
Do you think they're trying to position themselves so they pick up all those sort of, I'm on my way to a party, I need to get a bottle of wine on the way there? So instead of going to a Thresher's where you risk coming out with three bottles, you might pop into an Odbin's and come out with one, because you know you're going to get better value there than at a Thresher's for one purchase item.
Well, I think in saying that, I think you've probably put a very interesting dilemma in the hands of the consumer, which is, well, do I go for three bottles and get a bargain, but I have three bottles and I either take the three to the party or I take two to the party and keep one in my bag and take it home, or do I go to Odbin's and get perhaps something interesting but, you know, I'm not going to get a deal? Yeah, I think your thinking, Chris, is along the right lines, which is I think Odbin's have to zero in on the occasions for which their range and merchandising offer is the most effective. And they have to probably understand or acknowledge that for those occasions when everyday low pricing at, you know, £5.24 a bottle as opposed to, you know, half price seven down to £3.99, those occasions that seven down to £3.99 will be better for will be ones that the Odbin's now won't get the business for.
Just on something quite different there, Richard, what sort of wines are you drinking at the moment? You know, what are you enjoying?
Well, about 5 years ago, about when I started this business with my co-founders, I sort of bought the conventional wisdom that by spending a bit more on a bottle of wine than £5 was going to deliver you a lot more value. And that conventional wisdom is pretty fundamental now to the way I purchase wine.
That's
which is
because you're paying a lot for the duty and all that. Yeah, so there's a high fixed cost.
Absolutely. Anyone who's bought wine for a long enough period of time or works in the trade knows that, you know, once you go north of £5, you get so much better value than you did up to £5, because, you know, somewhere between 60% and 80% of the added cost that you're paying is going directly into the quality of the product. And, you know, so even going from £5 to £6, let's say, you know, is a huge step change in quality of the product. So, you know, once I realized that, I thought, well, actually, for the, you know, for the cost of a pound coin or whatever per bottle, I can probably live with the idea of spending a bit more if when I get home, you know, my wine moment in the evening after work when, you know, the kids are in bed and I'm winding down is that much more pleasurable. So starting from that basis, I tend to buy sort of, you know, £6 to £8 wine for everyday drinking. But I'm not afraid of shopping for brands that I know represent very good value, very high quality. You know, some of the stuff we're drinking right now is a lot of Chilean wine, which, you know, at sort of £5-6 a bottle can be just as good, if not better, than, you know, wine at sort of £9-10 a bottle that you would get from, you know, perhaps the old world and actually other parts of the new world as well. My personal favorite at the moment is Casillero del Diablo, which I think represents fantastic value for what it is. You know, I will continue to drink it and advocate it for a long time to come. In terms of what I sort of like in the more expensive stuff, I tend to go for kind of things like Pinot Noir and in whatever form it takes, be it from Burgundy or some of the New World places that that you can find it now.
Can't beat a tag of Pinot Noir. That's where I'm from. So
I'd heartily agree with you. And if I could only afford more of it, I would clearly be drinking it far more often.
Thanks very much. That's been quite interesting.
Thank you very much, Chris. And look forward to speaking with you again soon.